BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Terror suspects say they have a nuclear bomb in Europe, but this may not be just scaremongering for a change. We expose the shocking reality behind the rumour. And WikiLeaks has revealed this week that MI6's fingerprints have been found all over a decade or more of radical Muslims at London's Finsbury Park Mosque. And plus, how healthy is our local NHS? We wanted the chairman of Bristol University Hospital Trust, John Savage, to come in and tell us, but he's declined several times. Yes, the chairman of the Trust and representative of the West of England Business Lobby, John Savage, says he's not free to speak about the state of his Trust or the government's planned NHS reforms. Instead, I'm joined by patient advocate, critic of the pathology service and member of the Trust, Daphne Havercroft. We also look at the city's preparedness for a terror attack on one of our nearby nuclear power stations. But first, financial collapse looms for the dollar, and could Libya's confiscated sovereign assets be being used right now to prop it up for a few more weeks? Martin Summers, one of the stories that was on that Global Research website, the headline reads, "Financial heist of the century, confiscating Libya's sovereign wealth funds." And this is by Manilo Dinucci on Global Research, 24th of April. The objective, he says, of the war against Libya is not just its oil reserves, now estimated at 60 billion barrels, which are the greatest in Africa and amongst the extraction costs being the lowest in the world, nor the natural gas reserves, which are estimated about 1,500 billion cubic metres. In the crosshairs of the willing of the Operation United Protector, there are sovereign wealth funds, capital that the Libyan state has invested abroad. Now, what are your thoughts about this? Because we actually mentioned this a few weeks ago, didn't we, that actually part of the confiscation of the Libyan assets could be to help prop up the dollar.
Well, it might be. I mean, obviously, there's an element of speculation in these reports. We don't know what they're doing with the money, whether it's okay for the outside world to grab all of Libya's wealth held in foreign accounts because they don't like the government anymore is an interesting question, isn't it? What I think is more important is that the Libyan rebels have set up an independent central bank. It seems to be a very odd thing to do.
When did they do this then?
A couple of weeks ago. And it's like, so one of the first things you do, this rather anonymous, we don't actually know who the rebel leadership are. They keep saying, well, we can't tell you who we are because it's dangerous for us. So, but they have managed to set up an independent central bank. And of course, Libya traditionally, under Gaddafi, had a non-Western style central bank. That is to say, one which printed its own money rather than subcontracting it to the private sector, as ours do. And this all seems to me to suggest that there is an agenda behind the rebellion in Libya which we're not being fully informed about.
As we just heard, is that this oil, and very easy to extract it is as well as natural gas, as well as the Libyan Investment Authority manages sovereign wealth funds estimated about $70 billion, rising to more than $150 billion if you include foreign investments of the central bank and other bodies. But it might be more, even if they're lower than those of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Libyan sovereign wealth funds have been characterised by their rapid growth. What are these sovereign wealth funds?
Well, sovereign wealth funds, you can only really have a sovereign wealth fund if you're a resource-rich country. Like Norway, for example, has got a very effective sovereign wealth fund. That's what they basically use the profits from the North Sea to create.
Is this like a sort of like the Bank of England holding loads of gold in their vaults or something?
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, if you've got a big natural resource, as Norway had with North Sea oil, and if you compare the way they manage their North Sea oil, the way we manage this, it's very instructive. They had a nationalised industry which exploited it. The profits were all put into the national coffers, and a sovereign wealth fund was created. They were forbidden to invest in Norway, which sounds strange, but if you invest too much in your own country, you force up the krona, you force up your own your own currency, and therefore you actually choke off your own industry. So you have to invest it abroad. Yeah, if you don't invest it abroad, you actually mess up your own industry. But that means that you've got money flowing back into Libya or into Norway, which you can then fund. In Libya, they funded free university education, for example. Bit different from Britain, where you've got to pay 30 grand. In Norway, it funded all sorts of things like schools, hospitals. And all the social infrastructure which these Scandinavian countries take for granted, and which we still haven't got in this country after decades.
So are the Libyan people ever likely to see this, depending on who you are, $70 billion or $150 billion back again?
Well, if the Libyan rebels had won outright quickly, then presumably they would say, that's our money, we want it back.
I don't think that's what's going to happen.
No, it isn't. And that then means that perhaps this money will be disputed. I mean, perhaps that'll have to be negotiated in any ceasefire resolution between Gaddafi and the rebels, is who's going to get what of that sovereign wealth fund. But I mean, you can see that there's more to this than just humanitarian intervention. The Chinese are getting very upset because they've got lots of money invested in Libya. They've invested in a lot of infrastructure there, and they're fearful that the rebels with the Western support are just going to steal it.
Is this the same infrastructure that's being bombed?
No, well, we don't know exactly what's being bombed. We were discussing this earlier. I mean, who's bombing? What we really need to see now, I think, in Libya is a ceasefire and negotiations. And it's no use saying we don't want to negotiate with Gaddafi. I mean, he is the guy in charge. You've got to negotiate with him. It's like Slobodan Milosevic. This is the one you've got to convince.
So how likely is it that the aircraft will stop doing their bombing, and that there will be a ceasefire?
Well,
of some
at the moment,
sort.
At the
because
moment.
What we keep hearing, Martin, is that one side or the other side simply doesn't obey the ceasefire when there's one called.
I saw this in Bosnia when the Bosnian army, to whom I was basically sympathetic, refused to accept ceasefires because they wanted to fight on in the understanding that the West would ultimately come in and help them. I think that's delusionary. There is no real stomach, I think, in Western public opinion for an invasion of Libya. I think the rebels would be foolish to imagine that that's the case, although they are being encouraged in that view. I mean, they've basically turned away various mediators who've tried to mediate with them, saying, no, we want a total victory. I think that's unrealistic, and the West should tell them it's unrealistic and start calming everybody down rather than, you know, hyping everybody up.
Well, one of the possible reasons for this money going missing, whatever it is, should we say 100 billion? That's somewhere between 70 and 150, isn't it? This 100 billion of the Sovereign Wealth Fund may have gone missing is because the date has been announced by none other than the IMF itself for the end to the dollar. English language Moscow-based channel Russia Today's Kaiser report tells us this week. So here are Max Kaiser and his sidekick in the hunt for the financial terrorists, Stacey Herbert, discussing the end of the dollar.
IMF bombshell, age of America ends. The International Monetary Fund has just dropped a bombshell and nobody noticed. That's the important line there from Dow Jones Market Watch. Nobody noticed, because of course nobody in a cult ever knows that they're deranged. It's only outsiders that it was obvious to for years before.
That's right. Whether you're in Scientology or whether you're long the dollar, you're in an insidious cult, a snow globe of denial, and your world is crashing upon you.
Well, the IMF has set a hell bop date. They set an actual date for the end of this cult, and that is China will surpass that of America in real terms in 2016.
Well, it's already happening. I think 2016 will be the recognition by the U.S. government in the form of transferring ownership of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the biggest landlord in America, to the People's Bank of China. I've made that prediction before on this show. I think we'll see it in 2016. But the transfer of power is already underway, but nobody in America wants to talk about it because it might upset the popular delusion.
So, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, this whole idea of the dollar, an end in 2016 being announced to the dollar, but nobody noticing, is that really true?
Well, I believe it must be because these are reputable people speaking from reputable sources. I think the dollar may collapse long before then. It may collapse through speculative attack. I mean, you've now got cuts being brought in by the Republican Congress in the US, so that the stuttering recovery that we've seen since Obama came to power will peter out. And at that point, there's a real danger that it'll all just fall through the floor.
I mean, one of the things that Max Keiser and Stacey Herbert are saying there is that there's an element of them being in denial in the US about their wonderful dollar that's kept them wealthy country for, probably 100 years or so, actually coming to an end as a currency.
Well, it won't come to an end. It'll just nobody will want to hold it.
Nobody will want it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that the dollar, the Bretton Woods system designed primarily by Britain and America at the end of World War II, made the dollar the world's reserve currency. In fact, Keynes, who was the British representative, wanted an independent world currency called Bancor, but the Americans said, oh, no, we're not having any fancy currencies, we want the dollar. But Keynes insisted that the dollar should be linked to gold, and that meant that the dollar, basically, although was anchored to something solid. But in 1972, the US wanted to carry on fighting in Vietnam, but they couldn't afford it, and they started printing dollars and basically closed the gold window. Now, that was always going to end in tears. It's going to end in tears in a short while, because the dollar has basically been overprinted, oversold. And it's been a fantastic advantage for the Americans. They've been able to run budget deficits for years that nobody else would ever been able to get away with. But the game's up. It really is.
When?
Sometime this year.
Well, they're saying 2016, Martin. You're saying 2011.
I'm saying sooner.
Why?
Why? Because speculative attack will undermine the dollar. It's not a kind of a plan. It's just that people will just get panicked and sell them because they realise. And once people start selling, everybody else, it's like a herd instinct. Everybody just stampedes for the exit. And that's it. Look at the state of the world economy as we look at it today. It's on knife edge of disaster. And we're going to go over the waterfall. It's inevitable.
Okay, on to another story. We've heard this week that Al-Qaeda assassin worked for MI6. There's been quite a lot in The Guardian this week about these various stories and other newspapers too. But Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has been saying also, as well as that it looks like that there is a nuclear bomb. He's a senior Al-Qaeda member, that the terrorists have a nuclear bomb in Europe, which they will detonate if bin Laden is captured.
Well, what do you want me to... That's a whole series of things. What do you want me to comment on?
Well, that last point. I mean, is it true that there could be...
Well, I think...
Because a lot of this stuff is scaremongering, well, especially if it's coming from
someone. It is scaremongering, but as we've pointed out on the show many times, there are massive linkages between the Western intelligence services and so-called Al-Qaeda cells. I mean, basically, everybody knows, and it's historical fact, that Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western intelligence services to channel Islamic fundamentalist fighters into Afghanistan, many of them from Libya, for example. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which the West had been working with for years, provided many of the recruits.
Well, it seems to be working with them again now.
Well, indeed. So the idea that people have in their minds that we've got the goody Western intelligence services chasing around and the baddie Islamic terrorists that they're chasing, guys in white hats and guys in black hats, that's all wrong. They've been mixed up with each other for years. And one of the problems with this detention without trial structure which they've created, this huge global gulag full of people, it's not just that the rights of the individual are being infringed, which of course they are, it's that whenever they get caught out with their dirty tricks, they're able to just whisk the people away into detention where nobody can ask them any questions, no police officers can interrogate them, and so on. It's a pretty dismal sight, frankly, because it's been going on for 10 years now, and we must fear further extreme events orchestrated by our own security services, sadly.
Now, the WikiLeaks has been revealing things, a lot of things about Al-Qaeda, particularly in a report earlier this week. It's saying various things, like 220 detainees were assessed as dangerous terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, but at least 150 were innocent, although they were still being held there. Investigators are fearing that Al-Qaeda has uranium. I don't know whether they actually have any evidence for that, but they fear it. Pakistani intelligence services was ranked actually exactly alongside the same rating as Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. This is the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI. We also heard that terrorists are trying to recruit ground staff at Heathrow to cause mayhem at the world's busiest airport. Well, last time I used Heathrow was mayhem there anyway. And US terror targets were chosen first for their economic impact and then those which would awaken people politically. But the most important one is this one about a nuclear bomb roaming around in Europe which could detonate if Bin Laden were captured. Well, first of all, is Bin Laden still alive?
I think he's probably dead. That's what most serious commentators believe. Can I just comment on all of these allegations? WikiLeaks, just because something's on WikiLeaks, don't mean it's true. It may be true, but it's actually just another story, which may or may not be believed. The idea that these are super secret internal communications, and that when an opinion expressed by an intelligence officer in a raw report is leaked to WikiLeaks, and that means that it must be true, well, it doesn't necessarily mean it be true. There's all sorts of chatter going on all the time, some of which is true, most of which is not. So we can't presume that all of these allegations are correct. That's the first point I'd make. Now, we do know that nuclear weapons have gone missing. But not from they've gone missing from arms corps in South Africa. During the rundown of the South African regime in the apartheid regime in the late 90s, they had 10 nuclear weapons which they developed with the Israelis, 10 nuclear warheads. They approached the West because they didn't want a black majority government to have them, and said, "Would you like them? We'll sell them to you, because obviously we've invested a lot of money in them, so we're not going to give them away." And 6 were sold to the Americans and taken to Chicago and dismantled. 4 were sold to a consortium of British conservative grandees and then resold on to the British government, according to the Palestine Telegraph article by Peter Eyre.
Is it Peter Eyre? Yes.
Peter Eyre.
E-Y-R-E. Peter Eyre's actually got his own blog, and one of the things he's saying on there is the British government... apparently, nuclear bombs from Pelindaba were used under the nose of the United Nations. 3 nuclear weapons were part of a total consignment of 9 that were destined to travel from South Africa to Chicago in the US. It became apparent that Margaret Thatcher had made an arrangement with the government of South Africa and the US for 3 of these to be acquired and shipped to Amman for storage. The main purpose was to have these weapons on standby for possible use on Iraq. These weapons were then shipped in standard 20-foot containers and manifested as metal cylinders, not nuclear weapons. That is to say, the paperwork said that they were metal cylinders. This would have been in violation of international regulations regarding the shipment of dangerous goods, obviously. The weapons were then placed into private storage in Amman and left for Dr. David Kelly to carry out. This is the infamous David Kelly, who was either suicided or committed suicide. We're not quite sure.
I don't think he's infamous. He's famous. I mean,
famous.
He's not a bad guy, is he?
Okay, no. Right. To carry out an inspection in order to accept the consignment prior to final payment. Dr. David Kelly was the only person in mainstream UK Ministry of Defence tasked with being in the loop for that covert offshore procurement of battlefield nukes from apartheid South Africa. Now, also, David Cameron's name has been mentioned in connection with this
The shocking thing about this story is that it wasn't the British government buying the 3 nuclear warheads. It was a consortium of grandees working through a company called Astra Holdings and an arms dealer from Zimbabwe called John Bredenkamp. Now, the very shocking thing is that there was a big payback, you know, so all of these Tory grandees and the Tory party itself received £7.5 million, according to the sources for this story. Doug Hoyle, who's a Labour MP, did ask questions about this in the House of Commons. It's in Hansard, is it not, Tony?
Yeah, I've got a copy of it here. This is Hansard, the 22nd of June, 1993. We find the following. And Mr. Hoyle asks, if the Honourable Gentleman will allow me, I shall tell him what information is now given to us. We understand the expenditure and what the Tory Central Office receives. In 1992, Central Office received, this is Conservative Central Office, £20.7 million. Mm. When we asked about that and about company donations, the Tory party told us to look at their company accounts. I repeat, in 1992, the Tories received £20 million, £20.7 million. When the records were checked by Companies House, only £2.9 million was shown in their accounts. That means there's a deficit of £17.8 million. We want to know where that £17.8 million came from.
That's Doug Hoyle in the House of Commons. I understand from our sources that General Wild Boar Smith, who was the Tory fundraising person, walked into Tory Central Office with a cheque for £17.5 million, all of which was the profit on the illegal trafficking of the Arms Corps weapons. Now, the big thing in terms of our original story about a nuclear bomb floating around in Europe is that those three, John Bredenkamp, double-crossed, the arms dealer concerned, double-crossed the people he was dealing with, and he sold those weapons on to somebody else, so they're out there somewhere. So that somebody out there has got nuclear weapons as a result of this. I suspect the Israelis, but it's only a suspicion. The fact is that it looks like senior people in the British government at the time were basically trafficking illegally in nuclear weapons, making a profit on it, a big profit, and then actually losing the nuclear weapons they were trafficking, possibly into the hands of terrorists. Pretty shocking stuff, isn't it?
Well, that's an interesting angle on this story that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is saying that there is a nuclear weapon going around, even if he has been waterboarded.
Yes, I know, but we keep being warned by the intelligence services and Homeland Security in the US that it's not when if there is going to be a nuclear bomb in the US, it's when. And my answer to that is, well, you would know. You would know. Because that's the kind of thing that may well happen. It sounds crazy, but it's not. We're living in crazy times.
Okay, so if you want to check out that particular story, which is quite an interesting one, it's written by Peter Eyre, E-Y-R-E, and you can find it on various websites, including Palestine Telegraph. And
he's an ex-Royal Naval officer, isn't he?
And the headline of the story is, "The US and UK lost three nuclear weapons each!" Exclamation mark.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
In a minute, we'll be talking about the future of the National Health Service in the city, and also to what extent have the recent inquiries into the pathology department, to what extent have they actually been useful? That's after some music.
You got that keeps me satisfied. You love me so. We'll be right back.
from way back in 1998. That was Sonic with Feels So Good. Now, the chairman of the trusts and representative of the West of England business lobby, John Savage, says he's not free to speak about the state of his trust or the government's planned NHS reforms. Instead, I'm joined today by patient advocate, critic of the pathology service, and also a member of the trust, Daphne Havercroft. Hi, Daphne. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Tell us, what is a patient advocate?
Well, a patient advocate is somebody who has got experience of using health services and uses their experience to try and represent patient interests in things like NHS service reconfigurations.
Yes, like big things like that. But what if there are people out there who are interested in wanting to actually feedback, maybe to complain, not always complaining, maybe even patting people on the back about the service that they received. I can remember years ago, it was quite a simple thing. You used to go and talk to your community health council. They were very welcoming and they would lead you through a formal process where you could make a formal complaint and actually get an answer and draw attention to problems if they existed. So how does the system work now?
It's very ad hoc. The best way is for people, if they want feedback, to contact patient advocates, people who are involved in NHS service reconfigurations, and make their views known through that.
So how do people get hold of people like you, Daphne? You know, is there any kind of easy formal way to do that, or do they just have to kind of get on the internet and find out names?
It's really get on the internet, because we're all volunteers, we don't get paid for any of this, so our names pop up on the internet, on NHS websites where we're involved in NHS service reviews. Like, for example, there's one at the moment about the future of pathology services, so there's about seven of us involved in that, and we'd actually like more people, more patients and members of the public to join us and put their views forward about the changes. But it's difficult, there's no formal way of doing it.
Now, you said you've done this course in the US. What does it actually teach you about how you can represent patients' views and actually maybe even get changes if something's not working properly in the health service?
Well, this was something I did through Breakthrough Breast Cancer, the cancer charity in the UK, and I was fortunate enough that they funded me to go over to the United States and do some patient advocacy training with the National Breast Cancer Coalition. And over there, they're much more advanced than we are. What they look for is evidence-based healthcare. They've got a very good relationship with a lot of senior doctors over there, and their voice counts over there. But in this country, we are still behind, and it's still very paternalistic in this country. And I think the view is from the NHS and perhaps quite a lot of doctors as well, that patients, they need to be told what to do. They're okay to come and get involved in service reconfigurations as long as they're happy to roll over and have their tummies tickled.
Well, it seems like we have service reconfigurations all the time. I mean, are you someone that actually thinks that that's necessary, or do you think we're having too many of these?
Well, in Bristol, a lot of the service reconfigurations have been done under the umbrella of the Bristol Health Services Plan, which I think is now called the Healthy Futures Programme. And you can understand the principles for it, because we've got two NHS trusts in Bristol, University Hospitals, North Bristol NHS Trust. And in their hospitals, they've got the same sort of things going on. For example, in North Bristol, they do head and neck cancer surgery. They do the same at the BRI. So from the NHS point of view, if they can get those services consolidated on one site, bring the expertise together, it can make things more cost effective and has the potential to benefit patients, because it's bringing that expertise together. So that's fine in principle. Where it doesn't work so well is that the NHS, in all the service reconfigurations I've been involved in, what I say to them and what other people say is, okay, you are going to make some people travel further for services by centralising at a hospital. So therefore, you need to demonstrate to them that they are going to get an improved service by this reconfiguration. And that's where it really unravels, because our experience is the NHS doesn't have data on its quality and safety and level of service. So you get all these promises about, oh, if we do this, it's going to improve things. And we say, well, okay, what's your current service baseline? And then it all goes quiet because they don't have the data, or if they do, they don't publish it.
Well, one wonders then why that people are actually saying that there needs to be any kind of reconfiguration if they don't even have service standards for the existing service they're providing.
Well, I think if they want to reconfigure services but they don't have the data to say what the services are they're providing now, what it's going to look like in the future, it's all about saving money under the pretense of, oh, it's going to be improved quality. And one of the terms that you often hear bandied around is centre of excellence. I've yet to hear anybody in the NHS define to me what centre of excellence means.
Now, you were involved in the investigation into the Bristol pathology labs. It was a big news story last year where they explained how the pathology labs were actually delivering false reports, which were leading to people actually undergoing surgery when it wasn't necessary, and vice versa, actually not being told that they were ill. And this is actually really quite important. First of all, what is pathology?
Well, pathology, there's various strands to it, and this pathology inquiry only affected what they call histopathology, which is the study of cells and tissues. So it's if they suspect you've got cancer, they'll look at cell samples, tissue samples, to see whether you've got malignancy or not. So that's one part of it. Other forms of pathology are blood sciences. If you go to your GP for a blood test, that goes into labs and it's all analysed using a lot of automated equipment. Microbiology, if you go into hospital with an infection, the microbiology pathologist will diagnose what bug you've got and what antibiotics will work to cure it. Also genetics, so that it's quite a wide-ranging thing. And actually, I think the Royal College of Pathologists have said that about 70% of diagnoses in the NHS depend on pathology. So it's really important, but I think a lot of us perhaps don't, we go through our lives, we don't realise how much pathology affects all of us and our loved ones as well. So it's really important to get it safe and high quality.
So you weren't happy with the report, were you?
No, I wasn't, because it was all conducted in a very secretive manner. And if we...
But the report was published, ultimately.
It was, but the Trust, University Hospitals Bristol, made a big fanfare about it's going to be an independent inquiry. And the panel was appointed by the Trust, paid for by the Trust, without any external scrutiny. I contacted John Savage at the time and said, well, actually, local people should have a say in who is a member of this panel. It needs to come under public scrutiny for us to have faith that it is going to be independent.
That's more of a sort of businessman's way of doing things rather than a public servant, surely. I mean, surely he John Savage, is thinking like a businessman rather than someone who's serving the public in the pay. Public.
Well, I'm not quite sure what John Savage is, what his thoughts are, because in the business world, because I work as a project manager and service manager, and therefore my customers, if I'm delivering a service to them, then they expect me to be open about what service I'm delivering and what the quality and standards are. But the NHS doesn't seem to play by those rules.
Well, let's backtrack a little bit, yeah. Because what were the problems that had come to light that caused this inquiry in the first place in the pathology? I mean, I mentioned some of the wrong diagnoses from blood samples and tissue samples. Well, can you give us some examples of what had been going on?
Yeah, it wasn't... It wasn't actually blood samples that were affected. What this all went back to 2004, where and it's all about NHS reconfigurations, and this is really a story about how, in the rush to reconfigure services and centralise services in the city, for perfectly good reasons in principle, unravels if you don't do it right. And what happened back in 1997, I think it was that the NHS decided to centralise thoracic surgery at the BRI. So you might get a situation where somebody had a lung problem, might have been referred by their GP to North Bristol NHS Trust. The doctor there might have said, okay, you need a biopsy so we can sort out what's going on. They were sent down to the BRI to have this biopsy done. The pathologists at the BRI reported the biopsy. Patient went back to North Bristol for the follow-up with the physicians after that. And what was happening was that the pathologists at North Bristol were seeing the reports from the pathologists at the BRI, and in some cases they were saying, actually, we don't agree with this. And this went on, and in my view, and I think that's quite apparent in the inquiry, the official inquiry report, and also a response to it I've done that was published in January this year. Nobody took much notice about it. NHS managers carried on reconfiguring and trying to centralise services. More things were picked up at North Bristol in the areas of gynaecology, breast pathology and skin pathology. And this all carried on. Not huge numbers of cases, but a trickle of cases that some of the doctors felt, well, is this just the tip of the iceberg? Because at North Bristol, they were only seeing what came to them. They had no visibility of patients that never crossed the path of North Bristol. And this carried on into 2007, 2008. And instead of the NHS, because very senior NHS managers knew this, there's a documentary evidence that they knew that these concerns were being raised. They knew as long ago as 2007, 2008. So in my view, the obvious thing to do would have been to stop all reconfigurations, say, okay, we've obviously got a situation where there are different standards across the different laboratories in Bristol, so therefore we need to stop what we're doing, get pathology right, and then we can resume it. And they didn't, and in my view they didn't, because I think they were being driven by top-down NHS targets. You must centralise these services by this date to save money, and they hoped all the concerns would go away. So what happened in 2009 was somebody leaked a letter to Dr. Phil Hammond. It got published in Private Eye, and then lo and behold, we have this pathology inquiry announced. But the inquiry panel, when they were put together by the trust that was the subject of the concerns, they only interviewed people who were willing to go and speak to them. They didn't cross-examine them. In my view, a lot of evidence that was presented to them, they did not take into consideration in the inquiry report. And actually, North Bristol Trust itself doesn't come out very well from this, because they identified 26 cases which were reviewed as part of this inquiry. But when I asked the trust, well, how did you find out these 26 cases? Did you validate, did you verify that number with the people who raised the concerns? All I got back is, oh, we identified them from correspondence. And I think, well, okay, why didn't you sit down with the people who raised the concerns and say, how many cases do you think need to be investigated? So it's all very peculiar how that went on. And there's a couple of, I think, well, what I describe as howlers that are actually evident from the inquiry report itself, where you've got the inquiry report saying, oh, well, based on the evidence we've seen, we've got no reason to think that the BRI offers anything other than a safe pathology service. But coming back to them being very selective about the evidence they considered, one example of one of these 26 cases is a patient where six pathologists diagnosed cancer, and two of them were national experts in their fields, and yet the Royal College of Pathologists reviewed the case. Two anonymous pathologists on behalf of the college reviewed the case. Both said, oh, well, we don't agree. So therefore, all the six diagnoses that said it was cancer were just disregarded by the inquiry, and they took the views of two anonymous people. Didn't mention anything about national experts saying that this was cancer. And that's just one example of what's, in my view, is seriously wrong with the inquiry.
So, has it been sorted out now, do you think?
Oh, no.
I mean, it does. One of the things that really concerns me about this is simply the fact that nothing was done until something was in private eye about it. I mean, yeah. You would think if a place is being well managed, sensibly managed, it wouldn't take embarrassment of having something in private eye and on Dr. Phil Hammond's website. In order, who incidentally is a, I think he, I don't know if he still is, but he was a Radio Bristol presenter.
Yeah, he still is. Yeah.
For something to, for it to take that to actually trigger something being done about it makes you think that the management may be in denial. Is that what you think?
Oh, definitely. And if I take the example of John Savage as chair of the board, as a non-executive board member, he's responsible for holding the executive board members to account to look after the public interest. Well, I know, because I've seen documentary evidence, that John Savage was copied on a letter dated June 2008 about pathology concerns. It was a letter written by a doctor. And also there's documentary evidence that he didn't inform the Foundation Trust regulator monitor about the misdiagnosis allegations until a year later in June 2009. So if John Savage had been here today, a question I would have asked him is, well, what were you doing in those 12 months to investigate these concerns that were raised by very senior doctors?
I suppose that they were thinking, well, maybe this will just go away.
I'm sure they were, but if concerns are being raised by senior consultants in Bristol, if you were doing your job properly and wanted a thorough investigation and were doing what NHS managers are supposed to do, which is make patient safety their first concern, which is the top item on the code of conduct for NHS managers, you would have investigated, I think.
Do you think some of the John Savage and possibly other people just see you as a non-clinically trained meddler?
I'm sure they see me as a meddler. I haven't had any accusations about my credentials and my knowledge. I think that Bristol had an opportunity to sort pathology out, and it's blown it. So it's going to be very difficult to backtrack from that.
Well, what would you have liked to have seen happen then, as a successful outcome from this inquiry?
Well, I would have liked to have seen a proper independent inquiry under the management of the regulators, monitor and the Care Quality Commission, that was conducted under public scrutiny, so that we would have had confidence that doctors' concerns had been taken seriously. Because the outcome of the inquiry is that the doctors who raised the concerns are not satisfied that the inquiry took their concerns seriously. And since, a few days after the inquiry was published, there was another misdiagnosis that was reported in the Bristol Evening Post and on ITV West.
That's almost a proof that what you're saying is correct. That it seems that these the pathology certainly doesn't seem to have been sorted out yet. Martin Summers, I'll just bring you in on this, our old Labour Oxford economist. What do you think of what you've heard here about the way that pathology, particularly, but you know, generally, that the NHS is being managed?
Well, obviously, this is a very specific case with very specific features, and I'm learning a lot about it for the very first time from Daphne here. So I mean, I'm just listening. I mean, clearly there's got to be checks and balances in any system. What the critique of a national health style system is that basically the managers, the doctors, or the people at the top basically are not accountable for what they're doing. And that's got to be, there's got to be checks and balances in the system. Obviously, I'm more concerned as a political economist with the future of the health service as being pushed forward by the current government. I think that competition does not always lead to the best outcomes. I mean, if we look at the US system, which is a supposedly competitive system, it's a very expensive system, and a lot of people don't get any healthcare. And I fear that that's the future for Britain. But of course, there's always room for improvement. The National Health Service is not the best in the world, but it's on the top. It's in the top level. And if we spent more money on it and had it properly audited, then maybe it would be even better than it already is. But clearly, when things are wrong, they've got to be fixed, and that's what the, you know, what I'm hearing from Daphne is something's been gone wrong, and it's, and people are trying to cover it up. That's no good, is it?
Now, Daphne Havercroft, patient advocate on the UBHT Trust, could you say, because we hear that the foundation trust, or the trust is looking for foundation trust status. This is another change. It always bothers me quite a lot when I hear big institutions like the NHS, another review, another change. What is this going to mean? Do you know what will happen if it becomes a foundation trust? What's the difference?
Yeah, well, University Hospitals Bristol is already is going for foundation trust status next year, I believe. And I think that's been the policy from the last government, and it's being continued that all trusts will become foundation trusts. I don't know what happens to ones that don't make the grade, because they have to jump through some hoops with Monitor to be able to be eligible for foundation trusts.
Monitor? What's Monitor?
Monitor is the foundation trust regulator. So you've got the Care Quality Commission that regulates clinical standards, and Monitor is more about governance and finance, etc. So foundation trust status means that they have to be under scrutiny from Monitor for their governance, financial regulations. They have to meet cancer targets, all this sort of thing. But any surpluses they make through delivering health services under foundation trust status, they have more flexibility to reinvest those surpluses into their own trust rather than it going into some NHS pot and being spread more widely, is my understanding of how it works.
Well, one of the things we've been discussing over the last couple of months on here is the privatisation of the National Health Service, which it looks is rolling out over the next couple of years, with a lot of very powerful private healthcare industry lobbying firms and revolving doors between these lobbying firms and members of Parliament. Andrew Lansley, the Health Secretary's wife, being running actually a health industry, private health industry lobbying firm as well. What is it going to mean if the National Health Service is privatised, even if it is done bit by bit in stages? Because what they normally seem to do is let the private companies cherry pick all the services that the private companies want to, leaving the public sector to actually do the more expensive and the more difficult things first. And as the whole of the public sector thing starts to conk out, because it can't just do all the most difficult, most expensive things, so then the private sector takes over completely. This does seem certainly to me to be what's being planned with the National Health Service. What's your experience? And as a patient advocate, what can we do?
Well, I think we've possibly already seen some of this anyway with these independent sector treatment centres that have been set up, because there's one down at Shepton Mallet that does orthopaedic surgery, and I hear anecdotal evidence from people that they've had surgery done down there, and I think it was actually featured in Private Eye a couple of years ago, that the surgery, there have been some cases where it's actually not been done right, and then patients have to go back into the NHS to have it fixed. So this really picks up on the worry about, are more private sector companies going to come in, cherry pick the nice profitable bits, you know, the stuff that's fairly straightforward, they think, and do that, and then leave the NHS with all the difficult stuff, the trauma, all that sort of stuff. And also with pathology, there's a big review of pathology services going on in Bristol, which is looking to integrate pathology services at the BRI in North Bristol. And the underlying suspicion with that is it all being set up to make it nice and attractive for a private company to come in, like Serco have done in one of the London trusts, and make a nice profit out of it. So I think as well, from a patient advocate point of view, although we do find it difficult getting heard by the NHS, especially when we ask questions they don't want to answer, how would we fare with private companies? Would they be accountable to us? And that's a big concern.
Why can't NHS managers, even private healthcare managers, why can't they also be patient advocates?
Well, they should be, because the Code of Conduct for NHS managers says that they are supposed to make patient safety their first concern.
Because if they were doing that, then we wouldn't need people like you, Daphne.
No, and I've got better things to do with my time than go chasing around after the NHS.
So what's wrong? Why is it that certainly some people, whether they be managers or people involved in the health service, aren't actually advocating enough for patients?
I think it's a culture thing. I think if you Google whistleblowing, you'll find a lot related to the NHS. You hear stories about medical whistleblowers who've raised concerns, and it's happened in Bristol as well, over pathology, who end up as outcasts. They're not listened to.
Well, there was the baby heart scandal as well, back, 15 years ago, and there were people, there was some very nasty stuff talked about some of the people who were actually trying to make sure, simply, that the NHS was doing its job properly.
Yeah, and it's not changed. I mean, it happens to patient advocates as well, because those of us who are involved in NHS service reconfigurations, and I'll give you an example of the culture. This pathology services review was started last year. The NHS by law has to involve public and the patients in consultation, but they came up with this wheeze where they decided they were going to appoint their own lay representatives. Well, that is just so manipulative and controlling. And actually, the people they appointed didn't last very long, because it was just a completely bonkers idea. But, I mean, if we look at the whole problem with pathology in Bristol, the NHS is going ahead trying to integrate pathology services, which, again, it's the right thing to do in principle. If they'd done that years ago, they might have avoided a pathology inquiry and all the events that led up to it. But my view is that they're trying to sweep all the unsatisfactory outcome of the histopathology inquiry under the carpet and say, oh right, we're going to bring teams together and it'll all be all right, we've learned lessons, etc. But while there are unresolved concerns about individual pathologists and the BRI pathology department, trying to integrate teams is like trying to build a house on sand. You know, they've got to deal with the problem and start on a firm foundation. And it's their culture that means that they are turning their backs on it. They're not putting patient safety first. They're disregarding calls not only from the Pathology Services Review lay group, but from South Gloucestershire Local Involvement Network and North Somerset Local Involvement Network representing patient interests. People are saying, we want a forum with the NHS to discuss the fallout from the pathology inquiry and try and agree a constructive way forward. And John Savage and all his fellow board members are all saying, no, we've been stonewalled. So,
Does it make, I mean, one of the things that occurs to me about all this is it actually some of the problems may be with human resources, that things like the way that nurses and doctors are employed, say, for, you know, one of the trends is towards short-term contracts and also temps, this kind of thing. What are your thoughts about that? Whether actually, you know, the human resources, the old simply the personnel department needs looking at.
Yeah, I think that's a problem. The NHS has got this need now to save money, and their biggest overhead is people. And coming back to pathology again, one of the things they want to do is to, they've got this national drive to cut costs, but it's supposed to be not at the expense of quality, except they can't define what quality they're currently giving or providing. But if they try and just cut people, cut the resources they need to do the job to save money, that's not going to deliver safe care. And that, it doesn't just apply to pathology, it applies to other clinical care as well. So they've got to try and get the balance right, focus on quality. And actually, quality is, a lot of it is about finding better ways of doing things, more efficient ways, maybe investing in a bit of technology that will pay off in the future. But they don't seem to think outside the box in a lot of cases.
Well, going back to this thing about privatising NHS, several weeks ago on this show, the Lib Dem cabinet member for Health and Care, John Rogers, had this to say about the privatisation of the health service.
It's going to be a case that every GP is suddenly going to be going off on management courses. There are probably going to be in Bristol 5 or 10 GPs who are already being elected by their colleagues to say, look, we'd like you to make sure that the services that we get from secondary care, the way in which we work with the council, is as good as it can get. And they will be supported by plenty of managers, as they are now. So there's some big changes going on. I was at a meeting yesterday with chief executive of the council, chief executive of the NHS in Bristol, with I think 5 or 6 GPs and various people from the commissioning groups, all of whom talking about how we can make this work for the benefit of people in Bristol. And that, it was a very powerful meeting, and it started off with the question, what excites you about what's here? And the views around the room were unanimous. Even there were patient representatives there. Everybody there was saying actually they are excited by it. They have concerns, as the trade unions are pointing out, there are concerns in this process, but this is a very exciting possibility that actually Bristol can decide what sort of services we want to give to our patients, rather than having Whitehall dictating it, as they've done for the last 50-60 years.
Well, what John Rogers, Lib Dem cabinet member, was saying there on this show a few weeks ago, Daphne, was that patient advocates, patient representatives are excited with these new proposals for GPs to be running things.
I think they see that it's an opportunity for perhaps change for the better, but there's a lot of discussion that needs to take place, and we need to see how GPs would actually involve patient advocates, because we're not actually seeing that at the moment.
Now, for anyone that's interested in either becoming a patient advocate, doing the sort of thing you do, or else just simply making an effective complaint about a service that they've received, how do they do it?
Well, each of the NHS organisations, for example in Bristol, like North Bristol NHS Trust, University Hospitals, the Primary Care Trusts as well, like NHS Bristol, they've all got patient and public involvement officers, so that would be a good place to start to get involved.
Okay, and also you can just walk into wherever it was you were, hospital or GP practice, and ask them too. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Lib Dem cabinet member for efficiency and value for money, Cabot Ward councillor Mark Wright, and also thanks to Daphne Havercroft, you just heard there, patient advocate, and to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week we'll be poring over the local election results and the referendum. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear this and all our previous Friday drive times. Just go to www.thisweek.org.uk. My name is Tony Gosling. Thank you very much. See you next week.
And it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Prince William and his new wife Catherine today sealed their love with not one but two kisses on Buckingham Palace's famous balcony. Some 500,000 well-wishers roared their approval along the mall. Following a flypast, the newlyweds headed back inside, the princess giving one last smile and glancing over her shoulder at the sea of people. A congregation of 1,900 turned up to Westminster Abbey to watch the pair exchange vows this morning. Celebrities included David and Victoria Beckham, Elton John, Madonna's ex-husband Guy Ritchie, Rowan Atkinson and singer Joss Stone. Crowds of well-wishers packed into the streets surrounding the Abbey. These tourists are camped out since dawn.
We pushed right to the front and we've been there all day and it's been crazy.
Favourite moment was when Kate was almost in the church and turned back to wave for a third time at the crowds. It was amazing.
Stolen our hearts with that move. That was just beautiful.
Boris Johnson toasted the newlyweds with tens of thousands of people in Trafalgar Square. London's mayor said the whole day has been a huge success.
I'm very, very pleased. After all, the weather's turned out fine. Everybody said we were going to have rain.